Well, good morning. Good to see everybody today. In my Bible, I've opened over to the book of Ezekiel. Would you do the same, please? We're going to Ezekiel chapter 2 this morning to spend our minutes together today. Ezekiel chapter 2. While you're opening your Bible and getting settled and ready to study with us, we welcome all of you. Thank you for being here on this Saturday morning. I know there are just a lot of things that you could be doing this morning, a great many places you could be, and we are grateful that you've chosen to be here and to be with us. You and encourage us in that a great, great deal. Hope you can be with us this afternoon at 1 o'clock. I think the things we're going to look at today at 1 are very important. We're going to talk a little bit today about overcoming disappointment and discouragement as we try to live Christian faith, first century faith in this 21st century world. And it will be a very practical kind of lesson. It'll be a very practical lesson that I think we can apply in many areas of our lives, and I hope you can be with us then for that. I want to tell you how much I enjoyed the service last evening, getting to meet you, and you're so gracious and so hospitable, and I just appreciate that very, very much. Very happy to be with you. Well, I want to read with you from the book of Ezekiel, just one verse that will establish our theme for this morning, one verse, and then we'll give you the context in which this is found. In Ezekiel chapter 2, I want you to read with me, beginning at verse 15. Just look at the words with me, and then we'll give you the context. The words are these. Ezekiel says, I came to the captives at Tel Abib, who dwelt by the river Kebar, and I sat where they sat, and I remained there astonished among them 7 days. Well, what I'd like to do for just a few minutes this morning is talk about that simple phrase, I sat where they sat. And I want to tell you that if we can come to comprehend and grasp and apply that in our lives, it will transform much of our relationships with each other. I sat where they sat. Let me give you a little bit of the background that leads to that statement. Ezekiel went among people who were suffering terribly. And he was just overwhelmed by that. And I want to say that it took something to overwhelm Ezekiel, because he spent virtually his whole life working among the Jewish refugees in Babylonia, people who were out of their homeland. They were aliens and they were strangers in a foreign land. They were people who had suffered, and they had suffered a lot. Now, we know about refugees, don't we? We see them portrayed on the news all the time. I live in the state of Florida, and so we know about refugees from Cuba and from Haiti. But we know about refugees also from Afghanistan and from Iraq and from various other parts of the Middle East in particular. And so we see refugees all the time. But if we're not careful, we can get to thinking that refugees is simply a 21st century kind of phenomenon. And it's not. There have always been refugees. There have always been people who've had to get up and get out. People who've had to leave their home with just a shirt on their back or with what they could carry or what they could put in a car and push. I mean, what would that be like? I mean, what would it be like if when you got home this afternoon, if in about a few minutes, there was a knock at your door? And when you opened it, there was an armed soldier there. And he said to you, listen, gather what you can carry or gather what you can push. But in 10 minutes, you're going to leave this house. You're going to leave this place. And you will never, ever return. What would that be like? I want to tell you that it's been that way for scores of thousands of people. For literally hundreds and hundreds of years. When you look in the eyes of a refugee, they all look the same. It's kind of a hollow, gaunt stare. It is it wide eyes filled with fear and really devoid of any hope. No dreams, no aspirations, no plans for the future. Just a prayer that they will survive another day. Refugees live in the most deplorable conditions imaginable. Starvation, filth, unsanitary conditions that you and I can hardly begin to fathom. Ezekiel will spend his whole life right here. Now, I want to tell you that Ezekiel began life much better than that. He was the son of Uzziah. He was the son of a priest. And so he really began in better circumstances than that. But he knows who he is, and he knows what his lot in life must be. He knows that he is called to give his life to ministry. But the congregation that he is going to serve just happens to be the refugees, the fragments of the shattered nation of Judah. Again, people who have suffered, and they have suffered a lot. These are his contemporaries. These are his friends. These are his family members. These are his countrymen. These are the people with whom he has grown. And he learns to look at the world through their eyes. And he melds his message, not just a message of weeping for them, but a message of weeping with them. He learned to feel what they felt. And so he said, I sat where they sat. I want to say to you this morning, you can't do that. You can't do that with cheap charity. You can't do that with empty sentimentality. I mean, to do that, it's going to take a lot of effort. We get crusted over by things. We get crusted over by what we see. I mean, after all, we turn on our news every night and we see Tom Brokaw, Brian Williams and the NBC Nightly News. And we see these refugees and we see people in horrible circumstances. And we say to ourselves, well, what can I do? I mean, I'm just one person. But Ezekiel knew what he could do. And so he got inside their lives and he wept with them. Not just for them. And I want to suggest that one of the best things that we could ever do is to crawl into the skin of somebody else. Somebody who really has no legitimate claim to make on us at all. Somebody who needs us far more than we need them. I'm not talking about being a nosy busybody in somebody's life. I'm talking about doing what Paul suggested. When he said that we ought to do nothing through selfish ambition or empty conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. Because, ladies and gentlemen, refugees are around us all the time. People without God. People without a sense of destiny. People without a spiritual family. People who are refugees from the homeland that God wants them to have. People who are here, but their lives are difficult. Their existence is hard. People who are here, but they feel like they just never really fit anywhere. Refugees are everywhere. And what I'm saying to us this morning is that we need to learn to love the refugee because God has loved the refugee. In fact, the Gospels begin, Matthew's Gospel begins, by trying, I think, to teach us that simple point. You know, Matthew 1 is an interesting passage because the first 18 verses we typically overlook. We usually begin at about verse 19 because, after all, the first 18 verses just kind of read like a Hebrew phone book. I mean, who can pronounce these names anyway? And I will say this to my shame, that it's only recently that I have ever really done any preaching or really any teaching out of the first several verses of Matthew 1. But it dawned on me that in those first verses, God is trying to say something. And I think what he's trying to say is that Christianity is for people who often don't belong anywhere. And you see that in the lineage of Jesus. I mean, have you ever thought about the outcasts, the refugees who are in the genealogy of Jesus? You think about somebody like Jacob. Oops, let me back up there. Jacob. Jacob, for about 2 decades, 20 years, was a refugee from his home and from his family. And then it talks about his brethren, two of whom were Simeon and Levi, who did such deplorable things that their father said to them, "You have made me stink in this community." And then there are people like Judah and Tamar. And Tamar, who would seduce her father-in-law. And as bad as things are in American culture and society, I mean, we all understand how horrible and reprehensible that would be. And then there is somebody like Ruth. We say, well, Ruth, what? How was she a refugee? Well, she was a refugee in that she was a widow. And widows, after the cards are sent and the condolences are offered and the meals are prepared, why, often they are some of the very first people who are forgotten. And Ruth was a foreigner. She was a stranger in a strange land. And there was Mary, the mother of Jesus, who to all the world looked to be an unwed mother. And in that culture and society, let me tell you, it was much more scandalous than it is in 2009. And then, of course, Jesus. You want to talk about a refugee. Jesus, who had to live with the taunt, well, at least we were not born of fornication. Jesus, who would say, the birds have their nest, the foxes have holes, but the Son of Man, why, he has no place to lay his head. And then when you turn a page in the book of Matthew and begin to think about who was healed by Jesus, it's fascinating. The first person healed in the book of Matthew was a leper. And you could not be more of a refugee than that. You were beneath the lowest rung of the social order if you were a leper. And the second person who was healed was a slave. And I mean, you were only a notch above being a leper if you were a slave. You were chattel. You were property that your master could do with whatever he desired. And the third person healed in Matthew's gospel was a centurion, a Gentile, whom a Jew considered to be no better than a snake whose head was for crushing. And the fourth person healed in Matthew's gospel was a mother-in-law. And mother-in-laws, even today, are often the butt of bad behavior and often bad jokes. And on it goes. And the point of it is, I think that God is trying to say that he loves those that often are not loved in culture and in society. They were refugees all, and yet not forgotten by God. And the application, ladies and gentlemen, is that if we could just learn to get into the place of others, if we could learn to see through the eyes of others, it would change the way we look at them. We'd understand a little better why some people talk the way they do, or the way they behave the way they do, or some of the background and baggage that they carry into the relationship in a church setting just like this. It would transform our churches. It would transform our families and our communities and our world. Oh, we've got angels from heaven playing music. Well, I want us to talk about that for just a few minutes this morning. I want us to talk about learning to see through the eyes of others. And I want us in particular to talk about some things that often we don't talk about. And I thought maybe this morning session might be a good opportunity to do that. What happens when we learn to sit where others sit and to look through the eyes of others? For example, how does the world look through the eyes of someone who is chronically ill? I mean, what does the world look like through the eyes of someone who is chronically ill? I mean, they may be in a hospital, maybe not, but they're an individual who knows really that when all is said and done, they're probably never going to be much better than they are now physically. I think that's hard for us sometimes to understand because, you know, you get sick or I get sick and we know that all things being equal, through a confluence of time and medical skill and medicine, we know that when those things go together, usually, ultimately, we're going to get well and we're going to feel better again. But how does the world look through the eyes of someone who knows that's never really going to be the case? Somebody who spends every day in their own personal Gethsemane, and they know that they are always going to be a refugee from the hell and the well-being that they desperately want. And we know that we need to try to look through their eyes and put ourselves in their place. We know that we are to weep with those who weep. And we know that Jesus said, I'm going to bless you because I was sick and you visited me. That is, you did something for me. You tried to sit where I was and you tried to be a benefit and a help. But I want to tell you, it's hard for us to do that. Let's just be honest about that. Somebody says, oh, Todd, it hurts to do that. It's inconvenient to do that. And it is, in fact. The fact of the matter is that for those individuals, we hear their names in the announcements, we read them in our bulletin, but the fact is we have heard those names and we have read those names 1,000 different times. And let's just be honest. We are geared as Americans to have solutions that come quickly. We like everything wrapped up, neat, clean, with a bow on top, very quickly. We've developed, in many ways, kind of a sitcom approach to life. That there is no problem so daunting, but what it can't be handled and cured in 30 minutes or less. I was flipping channels the other day, and I happened upon an old episode of The Cosby Show. You remember The Cosby Show with Bill Cosby and his wife? I love The Cosby Show because they were a good family. I mean, that was a mom and dad who loved and adored each other. They loved their children. Their children loved their mom and dad. They were respectful to their mom and dad. And one of the very few shows on television that occasionally depicted mom and dad and the kids getting up on Sunday morning and going to worship somewhere. But on this particular episode that I stumbled on, it was the episode where the middle daughter, Mom Huxtable, was putting some clothes away in her room in a drawer, and her hand hit something, and when she pulled it out, it was some drugs. And as you might imagine, she was quite upset about that, and so was Mr. Huxtable. And so they're waiting when the daughter comes home, and when the daughter comes home, they confront her about this, and she acknowledges that, yes, those are mine, and she confesses to the fact that, yes, in fact, I've been using those particular drugs for a while now. But you know what? As the episode went on, the great news was that by the time the episode was over, the problem was solved, it was not an issue anymore, and now they could all live happily ever after. I want to tell you, real life doesn't work that way. I've dealt with many people with many various kinds of addictions, and I will tell you, none of that is easily solved. And yet, we want things to be solved quickly and neatly and easily so that we can move on. Hospitals are just full of refugees. I don't know anybody who really wants to be in a hospital. I have never yet gone to visit somebody in a hospital and gone in the room and say, well, how you doing? And them say, oh, Doc, this is great. Man, I love it here. This is amazing. I've got my own personal little TV. This bed, it will adjust in 1,000 different ways. I push a button. People come in to check on me. They bring me 3 meals a day. I get to eat them in bed. I'm thinking about buying a room and moving in. Nobody says that. Because nobody wants to be there. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, I have heard some of the most terribly insensitive things said to and about those who suffer with ongoing health issues. I sat where they sat. Well, secondly, let me suggest this morning that it wouldn't hurt for those who are a little older to try to put themselves in the place of those who are a little younger. Now, we'll talk about the reverse of that in a minute, but first of all, let me just say a word to those in the audience this morning who are a little bit older, and you know who you are. I'm not going to try to catalog that. You know if you fall in that category. Do not pat your wife on the shoulder. That's just not right. But it wouldn't hurt those of us who are a little bit older to try to put ourselves sometimes in the place of those who are a little younger. Now, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not trying to denigrate our senior saints at all. I think we have some of the most wonderful older people that are anywhere to be found. But what I also want to say is that oftentimes, as we get a little bit older, we forget sometimes to try to look at life through the eyes of those who are younger. And it'd be good for us to try to do that. As we get older, the fact of the matter is that it's so easy to get kind of set in our ways. We'd kind of like for it to be 1957 again. We'd like for it to be Andy and Barney and Mayberry and I Love Lucy. And we just need to acknowledge those days are gone. And Solomon wrote in the book of Ecclesiastes and said, "For what cause do you say that the former days were better than these? You do not inquire wisely about that." We sometimes tend to look at younger people with a jaundiced eye and fail to realize that there is so much good among our young people. I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I live in a setting very much like you do with a college. Our college that I sit by is not nearly as large as the one that you are, that you do. But I've lived for the past 15 years very much close to a college. And I've come to believe that particularly among us, in our fellowship in churches of Christ, not only from where I live, but in the places that I've traveled, I've come to believe that we are blessed with some of the best and brightest young people to be found anywhere. Young people that are morally and ethically sensitive. Young people who are trying to do right. Young people who are determined to remember their Creator in the days of their youth, who are truly trying to do that. And yet it's so easy, the older we get, to get kind of set in our ways and decide, you know, we kind of like the way that things have always been done, and we like seeing things through our own eyes. And it's easy sometimes to fail to even consider looking through the eyes of someone who is younger. I think it's been interesting in our churches to see the kind of transition that's gone on with some of our singing. At Temple Terrace, we have a supplemental songbook very much like you do here. I remember well when churches first began using those, and the complaining that some did about, well, we're just kind of pandering to our young people. No, what we're pandering to is some pretty well-written music that has a good spiritual meaning to it. But I well remember being in a gospel meeting one place, and then the evening after I had spoken, I remember a little old lady coming out, and I remember her pointing her finger in my face, and I remember her saying, "I tell you what, Don, I don't like them singing those new songs in my church." Well, I just took a step back because I knew lightning was about to fall from heaven right there. And I had to remind her that there was a time in 1860 when Amazing Grace was a new song. It's easy sometimes to lose sight of the good that is among our young people. Did you ever see the movie Hook? Movie Hook starred Robin Williams. And he was a very successful, high-powered businessman. He was extraordinarily busy, was really ignoring his young, growing children, his son and daughter. But of course, the storyline is that he really was Peter Pan. And so the evil Captain Hook comes and kidnaps his children and takes them back to Neverland. And so to rescue his children, he must go back to Neverland. And if you saw the story, you know that it has a happy ending, which all of those stories certainly should have. He goes back and he rescues his kids. But really, it's not a story about a man rescuing his kids. It's really a story about a man learning to look at life a different way. It's a story about a man learning to look through the eyes of his children, about a man learning to look at life through different eyes than his own. We do well sometimes to have greater appreciation for our young people. Now, by the same token, let me suggest that it would not hurt at all for younger people to try to look through the eyes of those who are older. And again, if you're in this audience and you are younger, if you're of the generation younger than mine, I'm 51 years old, if you're of the generation below mine, I'm talking to you. And I just want to say that you would do well to try to look through the eyes, particularly of our senior saints. Because older people often feel as though they are refugees, as if they don't fit anymore somehow, that they're not really valued anymore. And I just want to say to every person in this audience who is of a generation younger than mine, that you would do well to ask, you know, what would it be like? What's it like when the elasticity has gone out of the step? What's it like when the hearing is poor and the sight is dim? What's it like to be a person who has wept over many a grief and many a grave? What's it like to have that kind of mileage on the odometer of your heart? What's it like to look around a home when the kids are gone and a job place where youth is now prized, or even a church where you feel like you are not valued as you once were? Now, God says that there is an honor that is due to those who are older. That's just natural and right. The psalmist said, "Do not cast me off in the time of my old age, or forsake me when my strength fails." The law said, "You shall rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man and fear your God. I am the Lord." And I just want to say to the young people in this audience that not only is there just kind of a natural honor that ought to be given to those who are older, but there is an honor that is earned and deserved. The older people in this audience If you are of my father's generation, that generation made monumental sacrifices for us. George and I were talking yesterday that Tom Brokaw was right in his title of his book, The Greatest Generation. I think that really was the greatest generation. It was a generation of young 18 and 19 year old boys who became men immediately as they fought a war a world away and allowed the soil of foreign nations to be saturated with American blood so that you and I could enjoy the good things that we do in this nation. I don't know how we ever repay the debt we owe to that generation. Or even just thinking about your mom and dad. I mean, if you're a young generation in this audience, your mom and dad have made monumental sacrifices for you. And it's not just the sacrifices to get you an education, to make sure you get through college and get a start in life and doing what they can to help you with all of that. But it began just with your mother carrying you in her body. Allowing her body to be distended and disfigured as she carried you, to go through the sickness that went along with that, and then to go through the pain of labor and childbirth. Labor. My wife called that entering the valley of the shadow of death. But the point is, that generation made sacrifices. And that's true spiritually as well. You know, it's not my generation or the younger generation beneath mine that's fought the great spiritual battles. It was the generation of my father who really fought many of the great spiritual battles. Who had to draw a line in the spiritual sand and say, you know what, where God has not spoken and where we are given the right to exercise individual judgment, fine. We will do that. But where God has spoken about things, we can't step beyond that line and we won't step beyond that line. And I want to tell you, many of my father's generation paid a terrible price for that. And I'm just saying that we would all do well to learn to look through the eyes of those who are a little older. That generation deserves to be treated better than to ever be made to feel as though they are a refugee. And fourth, let me say that I don't think it would hurt us to put ourselves sometimes in the place of some of the minorities in our land. I recognize that when I say these things, I'm treading sometimes on a sensitive area. I'm not ignorant of that fact. But I will tell you that we would do well sometimes to try to see through the eyes of those who are the minorities in our nation. You know, we've done some terrible things with race in America. Things that if you were my generation or younger, when we see the newsreel and the footage, we just can hardly imagine happening. I know. People say, well, it was a different time. I understand all of that. But there's still some things that if you're my age or younger, it's just hard to look at and imagine that we ever did in the United States of America. And I tell you, we haven't always done right spiritually with race either. The very first place that I did local work was in a little community outside of Louisville, Kentucky. It was called Mount Washington, Kentucky. Little church there, wonderful people. And they were so patient and kind to me in letting me kind of grow up a little bit and get some experience. Vicki and I were newly married. And there was a wonderful couple in that church, that just an older couple, and they just kind of took us under their wing. She was a tall, statuesque, beautiful woman who had been very well educated, and he was just kind of a good old guy. He didn't have any education really to speak of, but he had a head full of common sense and he had a heart that was as big as this world. And they took Vicki and me under their wings. And it just so happened that they were black. And I would try to talk with him a little bit about things that he had experienced kind of going through turbulent times in America regarding race. And he just never would talk about those things. He said, Don, those things are over. And he said, things are much better now. And he said, I just, he just would not revisit that. And so I asked him one day, I said, well, let me ask you this. Did brethren always treat you well? And he said, not always. And I said, well, give me an example. He said, well, he said, all right, for example. He said, I went to a gospel meeting in town, and he meant by in town, in Louisville. And he said, I went to a gospel meeting, and he said, when I came in the back door into the foyer, I was stopped, and I was told that I couldn't go into the auditorium. I couldn't go in and sit. I couldn't go in and sit with the, and I said, with the white folks? And he said, well, yes, I couldn't go sit with the white people. He said, now they told me that when they closed the doors going to the foyer, that I could stand in the foyer, or I could go outside and they would open a window and I could stand out there, but I couldn't come in the building. How does anybody ever answer to God for that? How will anybody ever stand before the God who had the Holy Spirit put in the Bible the words that he made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the earth, and made every human being in his image and in his likeness? How will anybody ever answer to God for that kind of act? Our family over the past several years has become amazingly diverse. I have multiple nieces and nephews. I love my nieces and nephews. They have always loved their Uncle Don. Because when we're together, there is basically one rule. And that is, there are no rules. As far as I'm concerned, as long as nobody gets hurt, they can do anything they want to do. My philosophy has always been they're kind of like a bottle of pop. I'm going to shake them up real good, get them back to the mom and dad, and let them fizz all over them. It's not my job. My job is to spoil them. In the last several years, our family has become amazingly diverse. I have one niece that was adopted from China. I have another niece that was adopted from Vietnam. I have a great niece whose father was Puerto Rican, her mother was black. I have two other great nephews whose mother and father were both black. Now the reaction to those children and those families has been interesting. Sometimes it's been very funny. For example, when my niece was adopted from China, she was just a few months old. My sister-in-law came back. She was living in Middle Tennessee. And she's carrying this little Chinese baby, and she's in a grocery store line. And the lady behind her keeps looking at the baby and looking at my sister-in-law, my baby and sister-in-law. And she finally gets the courage, and she taps her on the shoulder, and she says, can I ask you a question? And my sister-in-law said, yes, of course. And she said, is that baby Chinese? And she said, yes, in fact, she is. And she said, all right, here's my question. She says, when that baby grows up, is she going to speak English or Chinese? You know, my sister-in-law said, we are really, really hoping for English. But I'll tell you, there have also been some terrible things said to those parents by Christians. There have been words spoken to them that no Christian should ever say. There have been Christians with some of those babies who would not touch them because they were the different. Do we really believe, ladies and gentlemen, that Jesus Christ was a white, middle-class American? I mean, I've traveled in the part of the world from which Jesus came, and I'll tell you, there are a lot of folks there with a little different skin pigmentation than I do. And if I'm not willing to love another human being who's made in the image of God, with a soul in his likeness, that he wants to use the Hebrew writer's language, bring home to glory, if I'm not willing to love another human being who may look a little different than I do, how can I say that I will love a Savior who may have looked a little different than I do? I'm just saying, it wouldn't hurt us sometimes to put ourselves in the place of minorities. And then one final application, that is, we need to be considerate of those who are refugees from failed marriages. And again, I know when I say that, I know that I am treading on some sensitive ground. Let me tell you and explain what I'm talking about here. When I talk about being sensitive to those who are refugees from a failed marriage, I am not talking about those who with a cavalier attitude violated their marriage vows and said, you know what, I know what I promised, but I do not care. I'm going to go my own way. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm not going to live with this mate that I now no longer love. I'm not talking about that person at all. I am talking about the individual who made their marriage vows and kept those marriage vows and did everything within their power to maintain that marriage that they had entered in, but they were married to someone, a mate, who violated their marriage vows and, according to the book of Malachi, dealt treacherously by virtue of their adultery against that faithful mate. And according to the book of Malachi, did violence against their mate by virtue of the way that they trampled upon and violated the promise of fidelity that they made to their spouse. I'm talking about the individual who wanted none of that, who tried to do their best, who wanted to maintain their marriage, who was faithful to their mate, who tried to be the mate that God wanted them to be, and instead their mate did treachery and violence to them and left them basically with no alternative but to put that individual away because of their adultery and because of their violation of those vows. I want to tell you that person who did their best and honored their vows endures terrible pain. Those who have experienced that will tell you that giving up a loved one in divorce is often more painful than giving up a loved one in death, because there's hardly any real closure. There are lasting scars. There's a terrible feeling of isolation and loneliness as your married friends go on with their lives, and while this newly single person is now often left behind. And I want to tell you what I found is that often these individuals are extremely sensitive to the hurts and the pain of others because they've been down the road and they've been over the course and they know what it is to hurt, and they know what it is to hurt deeply, and they know what it is to hurt without end. We would do well to try to sit where they sit. Be compassionate. Well, I'm just saying, ladies and gentlemen, that sympathy and knowledge should lead us to a larger love. I'm just saying that the more we know people, the more we ought to love people. I think about Jesus. Nobody ever knew mankind any better than Jesus, and yet nobody ever loved mankind any more than Jesus. And yet, he knew what was in man. He had no need that anyone should testify to man. He knew what was in man already. I think about the Apostle Peter. He knew what was in that man. And because of that, listen to me, he was able to overlook the impetuous words and the stumbles and the bumbles and all the things that he failed in. He was able to look beyond that, and he was able to look into that man's heart and know that inside of that man there was devotion and dedication, there was commitment and consecration to God. And he was willing to work with some of those rough edges and give it a little time and to be patient with that, because he knew there was truly a diamond, as it were, in the rough. I think that when we know people, love will do great things if it can, but if it can't do great things, it'll do small things. But it will do what it can. You want to know what the secret to the life of the Apostle Paul was? And we're not left to wonder about that. He tells us. He says, let no one seek his own, but each of the other's well-being. Just as I also please all men in all things. I don't seek my own profit. I seek the profit of many. I seek that, Paul said, so that they may be saved. And I just think for us. I mean, for those of us who have been touched by God's love and grace and mercy and forgiveness, it ought to be as natural as breathing God's air to offer His love and grace and mercy and forgiveness to others. I mean, after all, look at Isaiah 53. That's what God did for us. Jesus was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon Him. By His stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and yet the Lord had laid upon him the iniquity of us all. And the point of it is, he took our place. And by the same token, then, we ought to take the place of others. We said last night, we then that are strong, Romans 15:1, we then that are strong ought to bear the infirmity of the weak. People matter to God. And so they must matter to us. We must forever be a congregation of God's people that not only loves God, but loves His people and loves others. And when we do that, we complete the circle. Listen to Paul. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. He is the Father of mercies, and listen to it. He is the God of all comfort. And He comforts us in all of our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves have been comforted by God. You see a theme there? The point of it is, as the old timers used to say, God pours into us so that we can pour out into the lives of others. And again, if we receive the comfort and the care, the grace, the mercy of God, it ought to be as natural as breathing air that we offer that comfort and grace, compassion and mercy to others. The only way you can do that is if you learn to look through the eyes of others and sit where they sit. Well, thank you for listening this morning so very, very well. Would you open your songbooks, please? Number that George announced.